News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Today, we're going to double the story here. We're going to have double the fun for you, double the interest, and double the history, because we're going to hear from not one, but two World War II veterans. They grew up right next door to each other in a town called Willimantic, Massachusetts, a long, long time ago. And they've been together ever since. And we're going to go ladies first as I welcome in Phillida Brodalski of Atwater, California, 91 years old. And we'll hear from your husband in a little bit, but let's hear about you. You're growing up there in Massachusetts. You've graduated from nursing school, and you've already got an older sister who's a nurse in the service. Is that why you decided you wanted to wear a uniform too?
Yeah, it was one of the reasons that got me going. She, after Pearl Harbor, I was at Children's Hospital in Boston when it was attacked, and we didn't hear from her for 2 weeks. She was an operating nurse, and she was so busy that she couldn't get to wire us that she was okay. But that's how I got started. The day after I graduated, I took my state boards, and as soon as I heard that, I went in to the Army. I put in for the Army, and I went off to the Army in 23rd of February, 1942.
So now, I think a lot of people, if they've got an older sister who's a nurse at Pearl Harbor, they don't hear from her for 2 weeks, and they see all the carnage of that attack, they're going to say, that's the last thing that I want to do. What made you say, hey, that's something that I want to go be involved in?
In those days, everybody went that could. They all wanted to go, and I wanted to go just as bad as everybody else.
So what did you envision when you thought, yeah, I'm going to go be an Army nurse, and I'm going to take care of these brave men who were getting wounded and injured, and well, I'm probably going to have to take care of some guys who were dying too. What made that seem like something that would be worthwhile for you to do?
Doing what I was supposed to do. I went into the service, and I was put stationed at Fort H.G. Wright in New York, and then I went on maneuvers down in Mississippi, Louisiana for 5 months, learning to go to the Pacific, and I ended up going to Europe.
Well, naturally, it couldn't all make sense. Nothing did back then, other than what you were hoping to do. Now, let me sidetrack a little bit and ask you, what did you know about this tall next-door neighbor of yours named Ted at that point? Had you noticed him at all?
Yeah, I figured he was a nuisance. He was learning to play, what was the thing? The trumpet. And it just went on. And I told my mother I felt sorry for the woman that was going to marry him.
Boy, that's going to be an interesting story that we hear today. So you told me about the maneuvers, and then eventually, as you said, you didn't go to the Pacific. You went across the other ocean, across the Atlantic to Europe. You landed at Utah Beach 10 days after the American invasion, the Allied invasion started.
There were only 5 hospitals on the beach at that time, and we only had a 5-mile region they had captured. And one was going towards France, the other was going up the peninsula to Cherbourg. And we set up our hospital in a field, and 3 hours after we opened up, we had to shut down because we had 300 patients. I had them, I was pre-op nurse, I had them all over the field. I had them in 3 Army tents, hospital tents. We were just overloaded.
Now, I'm sure when you went over on the ship, you had an idea of what it was going to be like, and you probably felt like you were somewhat prepared for this, right?
Well, not really. You think you are, but boy, it's a lot different from what you think.
What was the hardest thing, the thing that really struck you the most and maybe overwhelmed you the most? Was it just the sheer numbers of casualties? Was it what they looked like? Can you give us a sense of what that was experience was like emotionally for you?
It was hard. In pre-op, we had mostly the patients with the broken legs and the, you know, the minor surgery. Major Emery had the shock tent, which is the beginning of the special unit that you have today. And We had a few of his patients that we kept if we had time, but mostly it was the minor surgery, if you can call it minor. And we used to prepare them for the surgery and get them through as fast as we could.
You talked about thinking that you were prepared, but quickly realizing that you couldn't possibly be prepared for this.
In our day, nurses didn't give intravenouses. They didn't do a lot of the things that nurses do today, but I learned very quickly how to do it on the beach.
Exactly. And I'm sure you also learned very quickly that there were some soldiers that you just couldn't do much for. How hard was that for you to come to grips with that fact?
It was rough. I can remember in Aachen, Germany, where we were stationed in a barracks and had made a hospital out of it. And it was Christmas time when the Hertzkin Forest began to bulge. And I came on duty that night, and the fellas, the Red Cross people had decorated all the rooms, and the fellas were singing and feeling pretty good because it was Christmas. And right smack in the middle of the ward was this poor 18-year-old dead. No one around him realized it. So I got him out, had my corpsman take him out right away. But it just hit at Christmas time. That was pretty bad.
I can tell it still bothers you today, and I think everyone understands why. I've got to ask you, at this time, and women were a huge part of the American effort in World War II, not just in the service, but back at home as well. But when you are out there, vastly outnumbered by all these men, what was that like? Was it hard to be a woman around all these guys?
Not really. You were just what you were. You know, you were a nurse or you were a corpsman and stuff. And I had two wonderful corpsmen. One was a corporal, the other was a sergeant. And they looked out for me. They took care that I didn't get into trouble, you know. And no, we all just like family, really. That's what it was like.
Did you go into it thinking this was a dangerous job, or were you fooled into thinking that since you were wearing a Red Cross?
I just knew how I was going to go in. If Lena could do it, then I could do it.
When did you realize that it didn't matter if you had a Red Cross on, or you were wearing a nurse's uniform, or you were officially a non-combatant, that you could be in danger yourself?
Oh, yes. We were in a rest period in France, in between changes, and one morning about 6 o'clock, this airplane comes over and drops a bomb just over the hedgerow from where the nurses were. So we could have died if it hadn't been a dud. And then another time was when they were strafing the road, and they would come right up to the area where we had our Red Cross, and then they would stop on the other side. Fortunately, they did that. They lived by the Red Cross rules. But if they hadn't, you could have said goodbye.
We wouldn't be having this conversation right now, that's for sure. What would you say was the hardest thing for you to overcome in your whole experience as a nurse in World War II? The biggest challenge, or I'm sure you had some days where you thought, you know what? This is hard. I don't know if I want to wake up and do this tomorrow.
You got very tired. We didn't have days off. You worked 12 hours to 18 hours a day. And some days it was just packed with ambulances bringing in the wounded that you wondered what in the world you were ever going to do, because you thought you'd never get through handling the injured. The thing that bothered me the most was the food. It was horrible.
You mean you didn't have homemade ravioli and spaghetti like growing up in an Italian family in Massachusetts? You mean you didn't have homemade ravioli and spaghetti like growing up in an Italian family in Massachusetts?
We have K-rations. We're pretty good. But then we start getting other kind of food. And I swear the stew was made out of horse meat. And I just couldn't eat it. That's why when we came to the end of the war, my heart had kicked up again, and I was down to 98 pounds.
Now, you mentioned your heart, And I don't think we touched on this earlier in the conversation. And I've met a lot of veterans over the years who maybe they lied about their age. And you had to tell a little white lie yourself to get a uniform on. Tell me about that.
I was doing private duty nursing, waiting to go in the service to take my exam, my health exam. And I happened to know this doctor on a maternity ward who was at Westover Field. He was a captain. And he did my physical, and he took 5 pounds off, and I mean, he added 5 pounds, and told him that it was a murmur that was generic. It wasn't anything else.
So you knew you had a heart condition that would disqualify you?
Yeah, Dr. Henderson had told me when I was in training, but I didn't tell them.
You must have been sweating it out a little bit to see if you would get found out.
I was worried that I wouldn't get through the physical, but with the help of my friend, I got into it.
So we took a little detour to fill in that story there. You were saying that after you'd been in for a while and been through some of these battles and treated so many soldiers, as you got tired, you were losing weight, your heart was bothering you again. How did you get through those situations? Was there something from your childhood, from your support system, from your beliefs that helped you overcome those challenging times?
I don't know. I just know that I was going to go in. I was determined I was going to go in.
What about enduring the rest of the war once you'd been over there and experienced so much of it? Do you remember a time where there was something that kind of lifted your spirits or helped you keep going?
Not really. You just enjoy doing your work, feeling that you were doing some good, that you were doing a place in the service that no one else could do. And that's what made you feel pretty good. And there were times when you were pleased because you could really help a person. Like that time in the Hirschkin Forest, I got a patient in there who was bleeding from a wound in his arm, and I knew he was dying because the blood was just pouring out. And so I gave him plasma and blood and shipped him into the operating room as soon as I could so that they could tie it off and, you know, do something.
And those are, I mean, truly life or death situations. If you make the wrong decision, it could cost someone his life.
That's right. And, you know, you had a doctor in charge of the war, but he was so busy that you had to do a lot of the things that he did, and you did them.
Well, I'm sure you always had as many supplies as you could ever need, and you had the proper materials to do every job you faced.
Right, we did.
I was being sarcastic. You really did?
We found out when I was in France about the RH factor, and here we were giving blood, you know, just to anybody without involving whether it was RH factor or not. So that was a big change when they started testing for that. So then you felt better because when you were given the blood, you know it was the right one and you were helping.
What do you remember about the war coming to an end and what that meant to you after everything that you'd seen and experienced?
We were in Leipzig, Germany when the war ended. We were on an air base, a German air base, in the barracks there. And I think we were all relieved. I know that they brought some wax in on an airplane, and that night the hospital celebrated all over the place because we were happy. Finally, it was over, you know. And then it was a slow trip back home.
And how many siblings did you have serving in one part of the war or another?
Oh, I had a brother who was in the Navy, and I had a brother who was in Pan American Airlines, and they were drafted in to bring the supplies to Europe. Then I had an older sister who was a nurse who joined the Red Cross and took care of things on the home front.
And all four of you made it back home?
Yeah, we made it back home without being wounded, too. That's another thing. I mean, we were in the middle of it like Lee in Hawaii, but we didn't get hurt ourselves.
And after everything you saw in your personal experience, you know the odds of all four coming home with nothing is
rare. Very rare. No, I consider our family was lucky. Even my father became a guard at the gun factory because he wanted to do his part.
Well, thank you for doing your part. I'm not done with you yet. I want to come back to you. You think we should get your husband's side of the story now?
Yes.
All right, we're going to do that. Ladies first, as always. But when we come back, we're going to hear from Ted Brodalski. He's a little younger than his wife, and his experience was a little different in a complete opposite end of the world. But it's worth hearing, too. And we'll get that next when Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I told you this week we get two for the price of one. Two veterans in the same home. They've lived there for 66 years, or at least they've been married for 66 years. They've lived all over the world, but for many years they've made Atwater their home, and we'll get the story of how that happened. Later on, we'll hear how these two ended up getting married, but right now let's go back a little earlier than that as we talk to Ted Brodalski, 86 years old, and a Marine Corps veteran of World War II, an Air Force veteran of the Korean War and Vietnam. How did it start for you growing up in Massachusetts? What about the Marine Corps made you want to say, hey, that's what I want to do?
I was in high school. In my junior year, I was 16 and 41 when the war started. September 42, my 17th birthday, I went down, signed up, and went off to Parris Island, started my Marine Corps career.
Now, at this time, in 42, correct me if I'm wrong, to join at 17, you had to have the permission of your parents, correct?
That's right. My father was a World War I Polish Army veteran, so he shook my hand and put me on the train and said goodbye.
Did your mother know anything about this?
Yeah. Well, she didn't have a choice. Yeah. So I had to, and my father was a true Army type trooper, so he was agreeable to see me go off and do what I did, because during World War I, he fought with the Polish Army and the English and the Americans. They fought against the Germans, and then after the World War I ended, then he went back to Poland and had to fight the Russians. You remember right after that they had the Russians, so the Poland had a real problem. They got slaughtered by the Germans. Right after that, they got slaughtered by the Russians, and so he came back. He had come to America before World War I, and then the whole group of his friends in Holyoke, Massachusetts, all volunteered to go back and join the Polish Army.
Wow, so I guess when you say people had no choice, sounds like you had no choice. With a legacy like that, if a war was coming to your country, you were going to be a part of it.
Yes, I had the real desire. And as Filda was saying, at that time, during the beginning of World War II, Pearl Harbor, you know, we're all mad. We all wanted to go over there and make sure that they didn't end up coming to this country. And during that time, you recall, we had scares of the subs and Japanese landing on the West Coast and all. So when it came, I got on a train the day after I was 17 and ended up down in Parris Island and got indoctrinated into the basic training of the Marine Corps, which was quite an experience.
A little more than you bargained for, is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, I thought I was in pretty good shape until I got there and found out that they were going to really shape me up, and they did. So I went through the basic training in boot camp in Parris Island, then I went to Camp Lejeune, which is further training. And I ended up going to the Pacific, and I joined the 4th Marine Division after they came back from Saipan Tinian. I was one of the replacements to go to Iwo, and it was interesting because we had no idea where we were going. I was with the unit, and everybody is saying, well, I think we're going to hit Japan proper, because that was in a sequence. And we went through Guadalcanal, the islands, and then Iwo, and then Okinawa, and actually they had planned on going to Japan before Iwo in Okinawa. And of course, we didn't know anything about that. So I always kid the people that are my friends in the Navy that I'm mad at the Navy, because when I was in the Marine Corps, They told me I'd end up in the islands with palm trees, hula hula girls, and I get on this boat, and we get to this island, and they say, okay, you guys need to get off here. This is where your destination is. And by the way, this is Iwo Jima. There's 20,000 Japanese want to kill you, and they're shooting at you. I was with the 4th Marine Division Command Post, Air Liaison Section. We were aboard ship in the initial landing. The general and the staff didn't go to ashore until D plus 4. We got into our setup with the command post, and I stayed with the command post. It was right below Suribachi after they had, because when they took Suribachi, that was the fourth day. Up in that time, the Japanese were up on Suribachi in the caves and everywhere. And for the longest time, no matter where you were, with their tunneling set up, you didn't know whether they were going to show up behind you or anywhere. And so we were constantly concerned with the snipers. When we first landed, they had the whole island set up with trajectory. Their mortars and their artillery, they had the whole island pinpointed. So when they saw a bunch of troops together, they just went to their maps, took their mortars, and boom, they got right to the site. So during the whole island situation, we had 6,800 dead, 30,000 casualties. So you know that whenever they sent artillery or mortar or snipers, someone was going to go.
Well, and something tells me that some of those artillery shells ended up somewhere close to you at some point.
You know, people say, well, how did you get away without wounded or killed? And I tell them, you know, when that mortar came in, it landed 5-10 feet in front of me. The next one landed behind me. The next one to the left, one next. And that guy upstairs said it wasn't my time. That's the only thing you can say. There was no hiding. That was a volcanic ash. You couldn't dig down more than 12 inches without it coming back in. Luckily, all us guys were slim and young, so if you dug down 12 inches, that was to make sure none of your body was showing up for them to shoot at.
But you probably had to dig your hole a little longer because you're pretty tall.
Longer, but no deeper. Yeah. And then later on when we had the command post, we had sandbags and stuff. The whole time until we ended up at the end of the island, there was always activity going on. And the saddest part is when you saw the bodies coming back in the cemeteries on the beach. They just dug as low as they could, lined up the bodies and covered them over. And then later on, they extracted them to a different area. The one thing that when I saw the flag of our fathers, do you remember seeing that movie? I was with the young Marines. We formed a young Marine company at a castle, and I was the executive officer. And we took about 30 young Marines to see the movie. I had never been to a surround theater because we never went to the theater. And I'm sitting there, and as the mortars and the artillery's coming in, you swear it's going to land right on top of you. The shooting and the volume of the thing. So when we got out, one of the young Marines says, was that realistic? I says, everything but the smell. Now, you know, when we went and had to get them out of the caves, we used flamethrowers. Probably the worst smell that they'll ever smell in your life is burning flesh. And we had burning flesh all over the place. And so you can think of all the other things that have happened, and that one thing that stands out that thankfully you won't replicate in life. All I can say is that the good Lord was with me. When we left there, we had so many casualties, we went back to our main camp in Maui, and we're reorganizing the division, and our next operation was going to be Japan proper, and the war ended. And when the war ended, they disbanded the division right there, And I have to laugh because now you got 30,000 guys coming back to the States here. And every ship that's in Hawaii, they're loading people on to send them back to the States. And so they said, okay, you five guys report down to the dock. We got a boat that's going back. We'll take you. Well, we got down there, and it's a DE-214. A DE is probably about 120 feet long.
A tin can.
It's a mini tin can. A mini tin can. And they said, okay, you guys are going. So we get aboard that, and the chief says, you know, there's no bunks here. He says, you guys are sleeping in a machine shop. So we went to the mess hall, and we went. Tables are waist high, and every 3 feet is a iron post. And I said to the guy, well, what the hell is all these iron posts for? He says, when we get underway, you'll find out why. Well, that boat rocked 55, 60 degrees. We got into 3 days of storm, which meant that the waves, they battened down the hatch, and the waves would go over the ship. So I didn't worry about the mess hall. Never ate a thing for 3 days. Spent all the time in the head throwing up. And I'm not a sailor. At least I would never want to be on a tin can. So we got back, and we got back to North Carolina, and then I got discharged, and I came home, and that's when Phil was, and I went out a little bit. She's a pretty serious gal, and she started getting serious, and that's when I told her, I said, no, I'm not ready. I went back in the Marine Corps. She said, well, the hell with you. I'm going back in the Nurse Corps. So she went back in, and she wanted to come to California. They put her Murphy Army Hospital, Waltham. I went to the Naval Air Station with the Marine Detachment in Quincy, Massachusetts, 14 miles away. And so that went on for months, and we'd go home on weekends. And first thing you know, we decided that fate was with us, and we're going to get married.
So try as you might, you couldn't get away from each other. And I want to get the rest of that story, but a few more questions for you about Iwo Jima and your Marine Corps experience. And first of all, speaking of your wife, when I asked her about what she remembered about you before the war as the boy next door, she talked about your trumpet that annoyed her. Did you take that with you in the service?
No, it's interesting because they asked if you wanted to be a band member. Truthfully, I played the trumpet. I played with a Polish band, played on weekends and weddings and showers and stuff. But I was poor on reading music. I knew I couldn't go into the Marine Corps band. I knew I didn't have that kind of talent. So I just forgot that and just stayed on with my military Marine career.
So it sounds like that was a wise decision on your part. And I asked her for her impressions of you before the war. What about you? What did you know about this girl next door who was a few years older than you?
She was a serious gal, lots of fun. I had the pleasure of eating many meals at her house. Her mother was a fabulous Italian cook. Anytime you ate over there, it was a banquet. And so I used to go over there when I went with her brother and enjoy the food there. She was a serious girl and thought she'd probably make someone a good wife, but not me at that time.
Well, you two were in agreement in that theory, apparently, at the time. And in terms of your experience in the Marine Corps, you mentioned Iwo Jima and where you ended up at the base of Suribachi. You weren't ashore yet when the flag went up atop Mount Suribachi, but most guys seem to have a story about when they saw it or realized it was there or heard some kind of commotion. Anything like that stand out for you?
We were on the deck. We were waiting to go ashore, and when the flag went up, we were out on the deck, and we saw the flag go up. You heard a big hurrah from the island. There was enough noise to move the island, but it didn't defer the Japanese. They didn't stop. So right after the flag went up, the general decided it's time to move the command post forward. So we went in right after the flag went up on the D+4.
That was really your cue to land on Iwo Jima.
Right. It was our cue. And it was interesting because the colonel said to me, he said, by the way, he says, we have a Jeep for the command post, and you're the driver. And I saw all that going on the beach. Everything moving was getting killed. You know, and I'm thinking I'm going to be a Jeep driver, but we never used a Jeep everything else was we walked. But that would might have been interesting because the way it was set up with the two fields and stuff and the way everything was done. You know, the thing that impressed me when I got ashore, you know, they had the concrete bunkers. Then they had the underground setting where they went the whole island, tunnels, okay? We bombed that thing for 90 days. You go and look at the pillboxes, and you see a little dent about 6 or 8 inches off the concrete. Before we went in, the Navy battleships shelled that place for 30 days. We thought when we got there, there's nothing going to be there. There's no vegetation or anything else. But they were underground, and they were up in Sirbachi in the tunnels and stuff. And the minute the guys start landing, they just come out of their holes, and we had a full-force fight. And a Japanese general, there's 20,000 Japanese on the island, and a Japanese general was known to have said to him, "You will fight till you die. In the meantime, kill as many Marines as you can. You're not going to go back home." So, you know, that's the kamikaze type deal on the airplanes. They fought till they were killed. And there was just a few hundred that were in the caves that came out. But they kept fighting until it was over.
Well, and I've got to ask you, and you mentioned the shells landing 5 feet in front of you or 5 feet behind you, but never on top of you, never where you caught any shrapnel, and you felt that God was looking out for you. Do you remember one specific day or one specific experience, whether it was that or something else, that felt to you like the closest call or put the biggest scare into you as still a teenager in 1945?
The first night that we were ashore, remember now, there all the supplies are coming on shore. Ammunition is loaded. There's stacks and stacks of ammunition on the beach. Well, the first night about 8, just after dark, the Japanese hit the dump. They hit one of the dumps. You've heard of star shells. That's the shells that go up in the, they come down a parachute, they light up. Well, that place was lit all night long from the shells. Well, by God, nobody was moving. You knew damn well that if you moved and there was someone out there, a sniper or so that was the one night that kind of got my attention, that if we had been closer to the bomb dump, everything in the area was blown up. So I remember that well, and that's another thing, that just being at the right place at the right time caused my survival.
Amen. Well, another thing that I have to ask you, because anytime I talk to someone who was at Iwo Jima, you have to hear about a Sirbachi story and also the image. And here in your room, you have a smaller scale version of the sculpture that memorializes that famous Rosenthal photo of the second flag that went up on top of Iwo Jima. The original sculpture in Washington, D.C., near Arlington National Cemetery, the Marine Corps Memorial there, is so striking as it sits larger than life. When you see that, when you're just sitting here in your chair and you look over and you see that with the red, white, and blue sticking up above those soldiers, what does that mean to you? What's the significance of that image to you?
When we saw the flag go up, we were far away. We didn't see the people. But when we saw the flag go up, we thought we had won the island. So that gave everybody that extra little push, saying, "Wow, we've captured the island." Well, we got Sirbachi, which was a bunch of caves and stuff, and we cleaned that up. But then the rest of the island is like a pork chop. The other 2 or 3 miles was where all the Japanese were, in caves. And so as the troops were going forward, you think that you're cleaning them out. In the meantime, they come in back. And one of the things I remember is the first fighter squadron that landed, Air Force Night Fighter Squadron. And they landed on the first airfield. The pilots were in their tents the first night. Japanese come out of their caves and stuff and killed a dozen of them. So you were never safe. And they would crawl around all over the place. And the way they hid the entrances to the tunnels, you never knew when they could come up and behind you. They had to, in the openings to the ones that the tunnels, they'd throw in the satchel charges, then they'd use the flamethrowers to get everybody away. But ironic, right below the tunnels was the raceway. They even had a hospital underground and all the ammunition and all everything, because they lived underground. So that the flag gave us a false sense of having gotten to the end, and it was, you know, that's D+4, and we went on till the end of the month.
The battle went a lot longer than the estimates were. So when you see it today, and you see the quote in Washington, D.C. at that Marine Corps Memorial, the quote on the side of it from Admiral Nimitz that says, among the Marines in the Pacific War, uncommon valor was a common virtue. What does that mean to you? And does that sound like what you saw and experienced as one of those Marines?
The Marines live by that creed. The Marines, since its inception, fought in every war and every conflict throughout the world. And the reason for the Marine Corps is, in the training, is a Marine will do his duty. There's never a hesitation. If the orders are to move forward, charge, and the firing is going around you, you're going to do what you have to do. The people we had on that island just kept doing their job, and that's why we were able to finally shut down the island.
One of the other thing that I've had, I think every Marine I've interviewed mention at one point or another, is that saying, once a Marine, always a Marine. Does that apply to you too, even though you spent so many years in the Air Force?
Semper Fi.
There's your answer right there. That is Ted Brodalski, 86 years old, and we're not done with the show yet. When we come back, we're going to get the story of how these two World War II veterans got together and how they've been married for 66 years since then. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've heard from two veterans of World War II, Philido Brodalski, a 91-year-old Army nurse. At least she was an Army nurse in World War II, and she's 91 years old now. And then we heard from her husband of 66 years, Ted Brodalski, who served in the Marine Corps at Iwo Jima. Later, he would serve in the Air Force during both the Korean conflict and the Vietnam War. But let me get this story, Mrs. Brodalski. You get back from the war. You can't get away from this guy. He lived next door to you growing up. He had that annoying trumpet that you wanted to throw in a trash can or something. And you've both been through the war, and now you keep running into each other. How is it that the two of you came to be married?
We finally decided to after we were at the hospital near Waltham, Massachusetts, and Ted was in Quincy. And we just decided it was time.
Now, he told me that the reason he wanted to marry you, at least part of it, was he was a staff sergeant. You were a first lieutenant. So not only were you an older woman, you were a rich older woman.
No, he's always used that story for the excuse. I don't know. We just start going together, and then finally we decided it was time we got married.
You had to defy one of your superior officers in the way you got married?
Priest that was in the hospital, the lieutenant colonel, he decided that if he couldn't marry us, we shouldn't get married. And I wasn't about to let him do that. So we went to the city hall on the afternoon. I got a free afternoon. It was a Saturday. We got married. And we went to Boston for the weekend. And when we come back, Colonel Anderson, who was my chief, wanted to know how come we come back. I said, well, you never gave me more than a weekend. And so that was that.
And you actually got married again by a priest in your hometown, huh?
Very much so. We went home the first weekend we had after we got married. And Father Donahue married us in our church.
Having it done twice, do you think was a secret to 66 years of marriage?
Definitely. I never would put it up with it if it only been once.
In all honesty, because we have an audience of all ages, and I, someone who's married only 11 years, I'm certainly interested in whatever secrets you have to share. But 66-year marriages are not the norm these days. Marriages don't last so long anymore. So what would you say is the secret to being married to this man for 66 years?
I think probably what we learned in the service made us endure a lot more than other people would endure. I really think so.
So if he could live through Iwo Jima and you could live through the Battle of the Bulge, then what's marriage?
Yeah, that's right. It's worth worth fighting for, you know, to make something less like that.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to go back over to him for a minute and fill in any of the blanks or get his side of the story if he chooses to argue with any of this. So we've heard about you had to marry the rich older woman who was a first lieutenant making $300 a month. Being married was actually the reason that you left the Marine Corps and joined the Air Force?
Yes. Remember now, I was in the Marine Corps. She was in the Army. At that time, there was no fraternization, so enlisted people were not supposed to fraternize with officers. However, being in different services, there was nobody to enforce that. Now, if I had been in the Army at that time and in her hospital, then we would have been subject to a reprimand because we're not supposed to associate with each other. She says she was a rich woman. She was, but I goofed that whole thing up. During that period of time, any woman that was on active duty that got pregnant, they automatically threw them out of the service. Nowadays, they give them some leave time for their pregnancy, and then they go back to work. So all that money disappeared, and we lived on a staff sergeant's pay for many years, and it was interesting. So the way I got to the Air Force, I went to pick her up one Monday night, and there was a recruiting, our Air Force recruiting sergeant that was on one of the wards.
So he was one of her patients.
He was one of her patients, and he said to me, how come you didn't pick up your wife this weekend? You weren't here Saturday and Sunday to pick her up. And I said, well, after Pearl Harbor, the Navy set up a policy, 50% of all the military people, Navy and Marine Corps, would be on station. Remember, during the bombing, the reason they didn't move any of the ships out of the harbor, 80-90% of all the people were downtown living up and partying. So if they had people on the ships, they could have moved some of those ships during the bombing. And they were just sitting ducks. So after Pearl Harbor, Navy and Marine Corps, 50%. So that meant every other weekend, I would be on the station. So he said, you know, if you were in the Air Force, you know, there's no Marine Corps stations next to Army bases, but there's Air Force bases next to Army bases. You know, you're probably better off to come and join the Air Force. And if you both stay in the service, you good chance you might be serving together. When are you re-enlist? And I said, in a few months, come down to see me. So I went down to Boston, and I changed over to the Air Force at the same grade. And I was at Hanscom Field, which is only 7 miles from Waltham. They had an Air Force Reserve training wing there. So that's where I started my career. We had our first two children there because we were there 6 years. And then when we went to Japan, that was in 1954. That was during the Korean War. I was assigned to the 49th Fighter Bomber Wing in Misawa, Japan. The wing and all the heavy maintenance was in Japan. We sent the squadrons to Korea. You didn't do the maintenance in Korea because you didn't have the facilities. So we had the 8th Fighter Squadron and the 384th Recon Squadron were part of our wing, and they would go and they would do their duty there, come back, and I was with the 49th Field Maintenance Squadron, which had all the shops and all the repair stuff. We did all the inspections. So we actually did 6 years in Japan.
And it was the Air Force that eventually brought you to Atwater at the Old Castle Air Force Base, and you've been here in Merced County ever since. Now, I've got to ask you, when you look back on everything, and you think about your two daughters and your three grandchildren and your three great-grandchildren, you ever think it's pretty amazing that they're even here to begin with all the odds that both of you had to overcome to survive the war and then get together?
We had the pleasure of having our daughters grow up and get married, and then they had children. And so when you think back, not many kids get to see their great-grandparents alive. We just are amazed that we've lived this long and are enjoying them. We do enjoy them. It's wonderful to have them. But I don't think we'll be around for their graduation.
You never know. You never know. I'm going to give her the final word here. When you look back on it, you've been around a few years longer than he has, and you're looking forward to your 92nd birthday in February, your 67th wedding anniversary next month. When you look back, what are you most thankful for? What takes your breath away the most?
That I had such a lovely family, that they grew up, managed all of them to do real well with their lives. They didn't get messed up like so many people did after the war.
And your great-grandkids are a little young probably to understand some of this, but if they start to ask you some questions and they say, what was this World War II thing all about? And were you really in it too, great-grandma? How do you think you answer that question? What do you want them to understand about what you and your husband did all those years ago?
Understand it. Everybody during that period of time was willing to go into the service. Because like Ted says, we were very angry about Pearl Harbor. It was something that we all felt we had to do.
Well, we're out of time on the program, but to Ted and Phylda Brodalski of Atwater, California, and on behalf of all our listeners, I want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us a little bit about it. Any final thoughts there, Ted?
Semper Fi.
Once a Marine, always a Marine, even if he spent more time in the Air Force. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. That is the program, as you heard it, Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ. But since this is the internet and time is unlimited, we have some bonus material on this podcast version. A few extra minutes with Ted and Phylida Brodalski. Some of the thoughts and comments that wouldn't fit into that hour time slot on Saturday afternoon. So enjoy.
We're originally from Massachusetts. We wanted to come back to California. We both in our mind thought we need to get to California. I put in for California. They send me to Westover Field in Massachusetts, 3 or 4 miles from where her folks were and my folks were. So we got to spend some time with the folks. And then I was with the 8th Air Force Headquarters, and I wanted to get transferred. Well, being in the headquarters, I worked in the weapons maintenance division, and the colonel I worked for, when my 4 years duty was over, I figured, well, I'm going to put in for a transfer. Gave it to the first sergeant. He called me up and he said, Colonel just threw it in the basket. He says, you're not going anywhere until after he left. Well, a year later he left. Now I got 5 years in, right? And then the guy that's there, I said, well, you know, it's a four-year tour. I really have the right to get a transfer. He said, not till I go. So now I got another colonel that's stopping me. But when I went to NCO Academy at Westover, I met this guy that worked in personnel at SAC headquarters. And he was in charge of all, by that time I made Chief E9. And he was in charge of all the enlisted assignments. And so I called him on the phone and I said, hey, these guys just won't let me put in a transfer. He says, well, bring me a request for transfer. The guy next door was going to bootstrap at the college at Offutt, and he come home on weekends. So I got the thing made out by the first sergeant. He hand-carried it to Offutt, to the SAC headquarters. And he called me up and he says, the only place open for a chief in California is Castle. I says, where the hell is Castle? He said, look it up on the map. Well, all you got was Atwater, you know. And I said, that's California, and that's how we got here. And so I did 2 years active duty here. I was the wing training officer. And all of a sudden, one day, the personnel called me up and they said, we've got an assignment for you to go to Korea. And I said, wait a minute. There's 12 chiefs on the base. 11 of them have never been off the base. They came here basic airmen. They've been here 10 or 12 years. Why is it my turn? Well, they didn't have enough time on their enlistment. And they said, you're going to Korea. So I came home at night and told Phil and the kids, well, I'm going to leave for Korea. And they said, well, we ain't ever going with you again. We're staying here. So I went back the next day and I said to the guy, where's the retirement debt? So I had over 20. I had 22 years. So I went over and put it in. And that's how we got to Atwater. And that was in May 31st, 1965, okay? So that took me. So during 63 to 65 was when Vietnam was going on. Well, this was the easiest assignment for me because guess what? We sent the B-52s to do the fighting, and we stayed here. So although I served during that period, it was right here at Castle. And then after I got out, I got interested in the State Military Reserve. Now, I don't know whether you know what the State Military Reserve is. That's the backup unit for the National Guard. It's a non-active duty deal. So I ended up with a battalion in Merced at the Armory, ended up being the commander, lieutenant colonel. And then Bob Calway, who was the chief and director of materiel up in headquarters, he said, I ain't got anybody that knows anything about the military, come up and work for me. So I had retired at 65. The SMR said, in the National Guard, you retired at 64, okay? No waivers or anything. So I went up with him, and he said, come up and we'll see what we can do. So I went up there and saw the general who had been down and knew me as the battalion commander. And the chief of staff says to him, we got a dumb Pollock that wants to be here at the Sacramento, who wants to drive 100 miles each way to work here for free. And the general said, let him come. So then I became the director of personnel and went into a bird colonel slot. So when I retired after 16 years in the State Military Reserve, I retired as a bird colonel. So from private to bird colonel was 38 years Air Force, or Marines, Air Force, and State Military Reserve.
Not too many people have done it quite like that. Now, I've got to ask you, when you look back on everything and you think about your two daughters and your three grandchildren and your three great-grandchildren, you ever think it's pretty amazing that they're even here to begin with all the odds that both of you had to overcome to survive the war and then get together?
We have the pleasure, we had the pleasure of having our daughters grow up and get married, okay? And then they had children. One had one daughter and the other one had a daughter and a son. So that was the grandchildren, okay? And then one of the grandchildren, the daughter married an engineer in the Army, and he did 30 years so he was a West Point graduate. Well, during his tour in the Army, every 2 years they moved the officers, especially in engineering. So here's this girl growing up with her father being in the Army, and every 2 years she starts school. And the father comes home and says, we're moving. So every 2 years, all her friends and everything else, she's starting over again. She hated the Army. She gets to high school, decides she wants to go to West Point. Graduated from West Point. So during the time she was at West Point, she went through paratrooper training. Well, when she graduated from West Point, they looked at her records. Paratroop trained, second lieutenant, 82nd Airborne, Fort Bragg, wow. North Carolina. Now, at that time, her father was on active duty as the base engineer, bird colonel. Mm-hmm. And when her brigade made the first brigade jump, he went to refresher training, and he decided he was going to jump with her. So they get on the airplane. He's all qualified. And as the jump master, as you're going out the airplane, asked whoever is jumping, when's the last time you jumped? And they tell him, well, 30 days, 60 days. And he comes up, and the second lieutenant said to him, when's the last time you jumped? He says, 26 years ago. And she looks at him and says, Colonel, what the hell are you doing here? He says, that's my daughter. We're going down together. And they jumped and made the jump together.
That's perfect.
Interesting. So my other daughter, granddaughter, went to a religious cemetery in Denver, met her husband there. They've been married 6 years. He's now the pastor of the Landmark Covenant Church in Turlock. And they're the ones that have given us the two great-great-grandboys and the great-great-granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And we see them every Sunday. They come over here and they play with the toy box. And and so when you think back, you know, not many kids get to see their great-great-grandparents alive. Mm-hmm. And we just are amazed that we've lived this long. And are enjoying them. We do enjoy them. It's wonderful to have them. But I don't think we'll be around for their graduation.
You never know. You never know. I'm going to give her the final word here. When you look back on it, you've been around a few years longer than he has, and you're looking forward to your 92nd birthday in February, your 67th wedding anniversary next month. When you look back, what are you most thankful for? What takes your breath away the most?
That I had such a lovely family, that they grew up and managed all of them to do real well with their lives. They didn't get messed up like so many people did after the war.
And your great-grandkids are a little young probably to understand some of this, but if they start to ask you some questions and they say, what was this World War II thing all about? And were you really in it too, great-grandma? How do you think you answer that question? What do you want them to understand about what you and your husband did all those years ago?
I want them to understand that everybody during that period of time was willing to go into the service. Because like Ted says, we were very angry about Pearl Harbor. And it was something that we all felt we had to do.
And did it?
They'll do it if the time comes.
Amen to that. Well, we're out of time on the program, but to Ted and Phil Brodalski of Atwater, California, and on behalf of all our listeners, I want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us a little bit about it.
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Any final thoughts there, Ted?
Semper Fi.
Once a Marine, always a Marine, even if he spent more time in the Air Force. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.